You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. What do you do if you're working in government and you see things that are illegal, unethical, or wasteful? If you become a whistleblower, you might solve the problem and you might pay a high price. But whistleblowing is a long-standing part of the American tradition, going back to even before our Constitution. In a moment, we'll be talking to Allison Stanger about her new book on whistleblowers. Stay with us. Support for the Radio Cafe comes in part from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Nora Ericott with Janine Jackson on Wednesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center. Nora Ericott is a human rights attorney whose book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, offers a new approach to understanding the Palestinian struggle for freedom told through the power and control of international law. Tickets available at the Lenzig or Lenzig.org or call 505-988-1234. I'd like now to welcome Allison Stanger. She's a professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College, and she's spending the year at Harvard University as a fellow in the E.J. Safra Center for Ethics. She's an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and she's author of the new book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. This book couldn't be more timely at this moment in American history where we've got whistleblowers testifying before Congress about the conduct of the president. What was your impetus to write this book? Was it a response to this presidency, or does it go back further?
No. I've 7 years of research into this book. So I got interested in it because I wrote a previous book called One Nation Under Contract, which is a study of the privatization of American foreign policy. That's the increased use of contractors instead of government employees in all these realms of foreign policy. And I began to realize that when the line between business and government was becoming increasingly blurred, that we Americans are placing an awful lot of faith in our business and government elites to do the right thing behind closed doors when we couldn't really see what they were doing or have oversight over what they were doing. And so I thought, how can we keep our elites honest in such a privatized world? And that's what led me to the topic of whistleblowers. So I researched it for 7 years. I looked at corporate whistleblowing as well as government whistleblowing. It went through 5 full manuscript iterations, and then it winds up in your hands in the form it is today. But it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get it there. But I think it provides a good context for understanding the current moment in its full historical context. So it's just good fortune that it
right.
came out when it did.
Right. Whistleblower, just to define our terms, tell me if this is right, but basically it's the practice of exposing illegal or unethical activities on the part of government and or private entities. And the practice of whistleblowing and the fight against corruption was at the heart of the American Revolution. What are some examples of what the founders were worried about and fighting against?
Yes, it's great that you bring that up because many people don't realize it, but whistleblowing is a long-standing American tradition. We passed the world's first whistleblower protection law in 1778. That's before the Constitution was even ratified. Hi. So the founders were deeply concerned about corruption from the beginning, largely because they saw democracy in England as a corrupt enterprise. It was corrupt because the British were hypocritical in their view. They treated people who resided in England differently from people in the colonies. And so they thought that the only way to break free of this corruption was to forge a new republic with new ideas, you know, based on the rule of law and the separation of powers, and somehow distance themselves from that corruption in England. So that first whistleblower protection law really is connected to that effort. And that story is quite fascinating of how it came about.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that early case.
Yeah, it comes about because the first commander-in-chief of the United States Navy, a man by the name of Essex Hopkins, was essentially using his public office for private gain. He was taking the U.S. Navy places where General Washington didn't command him to go. Washington would say, you know, I want you to engage the British in Chesapeake Bay. And Hopkins would instead take the U.S. Navy to the Bahamas.
Right.
And he did so to serve his commercial interests, which were very much bound up in the slave trade. So, you know, 60 to 90% of the slave trade went through Rhode Island ports. And Hopkins was a Rhode Islander. So he really was just using his position to, in a sense, promote himself and to enrich himself and his cronies. And 10 sailors on his ship blew the whistle on him for other reasons. They were concerned that he had tortured British prisoners of war. But my research really showed that that was just the tip of the iceberg. He was also doing these other things. And Congress, when they removed him from office, was more concerned about that abuse of power. But they stood firmly with whistleblowers. They paid the bail for 2 of the 10 sailors who had the misfortune of being Rhode Island residents. That's where Hopkins really had enormous social power. So they were imprisoned and charged with libel. Congress sprung them from jail. Congress paid their legal fees. And Congress also legislated that all those documents related to the Hopkins affair be released to the public, which is the reason we can tell the story today.
Yeah.
So whistleblowing really is in our DNA.
Yeah, very much so. And it's so interesting for me to read about this early corruption because, I mean, it's so familiar. It makes you feel how little has changed. I mean, you've got, you know, you tell stories of government contractors overcharging, providing shoddy merchandise, basically transferring as much taxpayer money into their own pockets as they possibly can. You give examples from the Civil War, you know, the Brooks Brothers. I didn't know Brooks Brothers was that old and providing poorly produced uniforms and things like that.
Yeah.
But what were the incentives and disincentives as, you know, as the 19th century came and the Civil War and great transformations in society for reporting misdeeds?
The incentives shift from time to time, and they're shaped by both, you know, public opinion, and they're shaped by the laws on the books at the time. So the whole sweep of American history can really be understood from that first moment I described to you as a series of legislative efforts to keep the Republic on track and prevent corruption. And then elites will figure out a way to kind of get around it, and then Congress has to act again. So you brought up the Civil War case. There was all this wartime profiteering, and firms like Brooks Brothers, as you mentioned, were essentially profiting from the war effort rather than trying to serve the cause of the Union Army. So Brooks Brothers was selling uniforms made from shoddy, was the type of material, which would disintegrate 2 to 3 days after you wore the uniform. That's where the term shoddy comes from.
Right.
And President Lincoln thought this was a disgrace. And so he passed the Lincoln Law, which allowed people to report that kind of corruption and sue to get the money back for the American taxpayer. And in those qui tam cases that were successful, the person who actually filed the complaint would get a percentage of the money returned to the government. So that's something that dates back to the Civil War. And if we want to look at even this current whistleblower complaint, the whole intelligence community inspector general system was set up in response to Watergate. So that was Congress legislating to be sure that Nixon's abuse of power would not happen again. Obviously, there's never a permanent fix. You've got to keep moving and trying to address corruption when you see it if you're going to keep democracy alive.
And we will get to all that in a moment because
sure.
It's very important. But one of the things that I think is interesting and important in the context of the whole thing is that whistleblowers don't always have pure motives, though sometimes they do. But you give examples of where they are exposing real corruption or wrongdoing, but it's also to their advantage to do so, whether it be electoral politics or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And it's often misunderstood in the current context that the motives of the whistleblower don't matter. It's the content of their complaint that matters. And you can spend a lot of time trying to figure out people's motives. Humans are really complicated. And the good news is that with a whistleblower, you don't have to figure out what they are. In many instances, take Mark Felt, for example, who is Deep Throat in Watergate. His motives were less than honorable. He released that information, and it really helped him in his battle with a rival. Felt wanted to be director of the FBI, and by releasing that information, he really hurt his rival's chances for the same position. But that doesn't really matter, because the sort of misconduct he brought to light was something the American people needed to know about. And the same is true of any whistleblower. A whistleblower is really someone who speaks truth to power, exposes wrongdoing, either illegal or unconstitutional, and what kind of person they are is really irrelevant. It's the facts of what they're reporting that should concern us.
Yeah, really, that very important indeed. There was some interesting kind of complexity during westward expansion when the people who were building the railroads, for example, were getting very rich off of government contracts, but they also felt like they were participating in building the country, and so their work was for the common good. Or that you give similar examples in like real estate development, where people got very wealthy developing the city, but they were developing the city. So did that kind of attitude or fact that they were doing something that was considered good help these sort of moguls get away with corrupt practices? Or did whistleblowers, were they still able to, you know, bring corruption to light?
Those cases are so interesting, especially compared with today, because if you take someone like Boss Tweed or the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, there are horrific graft schemes associated with that, where people are getting rich as the country is being built. And that's corruption. Whenever people are skimming money off into their pockets, taxpayer money, you know, that's not serving the American people. That's serving certain individuals. And I think they tell themselves that they're doing it for the country, so they deserve a little bit on the side, but that's illegal. And with those cases, you have enormous public scandals. You know, Boss Tweed, for example, in New York City, which shows you that whistleblowing is not partisan. He's a Democrat. He really built New York City as we know it today, but at the same time, he was enormously corrupt with vote buying, but also with all kinds of fraud that allowed him to pay off his cronies as he did these various infrastructure projects. Now, what's interesting there in context today is a lot of today's corruption doesn't really build anything. I would love it if infrastructure were built in the midst of all this corruption. But the other thing that's so distinctive is we've really lost, and there are certain people who are actively bent on destroying the very concept of disinterested public service, the idea that you would serve your country rather than yourself, which is very at the heart of the whole definition of corruption. You know, Essex Hopkins served himself rather than his country. We seem to have lost a sense of public service. And so what happens is, in contrast to, say, the first Gilded Age, you don't get the same sort of public indignation. So when Boss Tweed is exposed for his money laundering and corruption schemes in New York City in the first Gilded Age, he goes immediately to jail. He dies in disgrace. The public is horrified once those secrets come to light. Today, we seem to be confused about, you know, there's corruption all around us, and we seem to think it doesn't even really matter. And that's unfortunate, something we definitely need to change, because it does matter if we want to keep democracy alive.
Well, you say we. I mean, some segment of the American public is in a state of continual, unending horror at what's happening. Are they not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you see, you know, with the recent testimony of these public servants at the State Department, that they're in the work I did for this book, I did a lot of interviews with members of the intelligence community, State Department, all sorts of realms of government. And it really is true that there is what Donald Trump would call the deep state is really the civil service.
Right.
These are people who are committed to serving their country, and they stay in place with their jobs regardless of whether a Democrat or Republican is at the helm, and they serve their country. And that very notion is being challenged, the idea that you could be a sort of person who would be out for serving your country rather than yourself, that's being challenged as impossible. And it simply isn't the case. You run into so many people who validate your sense that some people aren't in it for the money. You know, people in public service aren't in it for the money, because you don't do it for that reason. And we're destroying that notion of public service that's so important for keeping our constitutional democracy sustainable.
It's funny. I mean, you say they're not in it for the money, but it is a, you know, reasonably well-paid, lifelong, if you don't mess up, steady paycheck and solid career. And I think a lot of people still do go into public service for those reasons, whether it be something simple as a school teacher or working for the city or working in the diplomatic corps. But as you say, I mean, this part of the story of government corruption has to do with privatization and the proverbial revolving door between government and the private sector. And you cite this amazing statistic that in 1970, only 3% of people who left their jobs, you know, their leadership roles in the U.S. Congress, senators and representatives, went into lobbying when they left office. And now it's 50%. So the implications of that for our system of government and for those who want to expose corruption, I mean, it's really changed.
Yes, we've had kind of a sea change in attitudes about public service and about those things that only government can do well. So a couple decades ago, if someone left government for the private sector, it used to be called selling out. You were selling out. You were no longer taking the high road. You were going to make money instead. Now that same movement from government to the private sector is called cashing in. It's seen as the smart thing you do after serving in government, is you monetize that experience. And that's had some real problematic implications for democracy, because the private sector is fantastic for all sorts of reasons. I am a big supporter of free markets and capitalism. But if you're going to trust the private sector to uphold the public interest, you're going to be deeply disappointed, because government exists for another reason. Government is really just another word for the things we do together. And government upholds the common good, provides public goods, which is a very different function than the private sector, which exists to make money. So we really get into quite a bit of trouble when we get confused about the purposes of business and government and think they're actually intertwined when they're not.
I've heard it said that capitalism is fire and government is the fireplace. So if you take away the fireplace, your house burns down. And
That's good.
And on some level, I mean, capitalism has to be contained and regulated in the same way that fire has to be regulated, or in the same way that our body temperature has to be regulated and all the functions of our body, in the same thing applies to the body politic. You have to contain it. And gone are the days where government regulators and the people they're regulating are at odds. They're in bed together, and the rest of us seemingly have no power.
Yes, and that is part of the reason why this is a real age of whistleblowers, right? Because when you have that kind of alliance between business and government and a gap between the elites and most Americans, you need whistleblowers to, in a sense, keep the elites honest and speak truth to power. And you not only need them, you need them to be protected and celebrated, which unfortunately isn't the case and has not been so throughout American history, because even though American whistleblowing is in America's DNA and has been something present since the founding, the standard practice, which you see time and time again, is that when media attention turns elsewhere, that same whistleblower that's celebrated winds up losing everything. They lose their career, their friends and family are retaliated against, and that's something that we could do a better job with.
Well, let's talk about the case of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, a story which many people know and movies have been made about it. This is a case of a whistleblower who really was, I mean, had, I think, pure motives. He was acting out of conscience and tried very hard to work through the inside channels before he took the Pentagon Papers to the media. What were his concerns, and why didn't he get anywhere with the, you know, going through the proper channels?
Yeah, that's a great question, because Ellsberg was your quintessential insider, and he knew senators and he knew Henry Kissinger. He talked with all of those people about the Pentagon Papers and this gap between what the administration was telling the American people about the Vietnam War and what those papers actually showed was actually taking place. And he couldn't get anybody to read that information into the public record so that the American people could know about it. And in frustration, he then turned the documents over to the New York Times. Now, interestingly enough, because he had tried so hard to complain through inside channels, when the New York Times ran the first story about the Pentagon Papers, Washington insiders immediately knew it was Ellsberg who was the leak,
right,
who was the whistleblower. And they didn't have to print his name or say anything about it. The New York Times protected their source, but Washington knew. And I think something quite similar is happening today with this CIA whistleblower who's led to the current impeachment hearings. I think Washington insiders know who that individual is. But the circumstances are a bit more dangerous because of the White House threatening by a tweet to retaliate, you know, encouraging its supporters really to retaliate against the whistleblower, out the whistleblower. I don't have to repeat all the various tactics that have been used to distract us from the matter at hand. But this is a very different media situation than at the time of Daniel Ellsberg. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg was running around. He had to Xerox the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
Now, in the digital age, it's much easier to steal information and to leak it to the public.
Well, that particular case led to a Supreme Court decision in favor of the New York Times and the newspapers that printed the Pentagon Papers. But ironically, they were protected and Ellsberg wasn't. Why not? I thought we've had whistleblower protection since before the Constitution was even written.
Well, yes, we have. But, you know, there's always room for refinement. And in the national security realm, it's particularly fraught. And we're still fighting this battle today. If you look at the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1989, and it was updated in 2012, you will find that it provides protection to all government employees except members of the intelligence community. They are explicitly exempt from protection. And that's because in the intelligence community and even in the national security realm more broadly, employees have to protect classified information as part of their job. And obviously, blowing the whistle typically involves the release of classified information. Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers were classified. So by releasing it to the public, Ellsberg was breaking the law. So that's why that particular area for whistleblowing is difficult. It's the reason why President Obama passed an executive order, Presidential Policy Directive 19, which really helped to clarify how you could have whistleblowing in the intelligence community. Incidentally, that's the channel through which this whistleblower complaint rose. But even with that executive order, it's still murky business. And we could definitely clarify things so that national security whistleblowers would know they'd receive protection with a legitimate complaint.
Well, and I mean, I think it's important to note that Daniel Ellsberg and, you know, Edward Snowden also, I mean, didn't release these things to the public. Well, there wasn't the internet at the time, but released them mm-hmm. to journalists with the understanding that journalists have a duty to both inform the public and protect national security, and that they weren't going to release the whole thing uncensored, but they would do their best to expose corruption and protect security at the same time. That is,
yeah.
So that's the kind of job of the Fourth Estate when they are leaked to in that way.
Yes, that's an important point. They both did take pains to make sure this sensitive material was handled properly. And with the case of Snowden, obviously, you'll see a lot of people saying that he was working for the Russians or he caused endless damage to American assets overseas. But if you actually look at the record, and I do that quite carefully in the book, you'll find that the negative consequences are definitely less than the positive consequences of bringing this information to light. Because what Snowden revealed is really a sea change in national security operating procedures after 9/11. We were attacked, the nation was at war, and so the NSA adopted emergency procedures. And in my opinion, they were right to do so. It was an emergency moment. But what happened is that over time, those emergency procedures became business as usual without any kind of public discussion. And that's the public discussion that Snowden initiated. And arguably, he provided a public service in so doing because the Patriot Act was changed. The laws were changed in response to that information. We've got a very large national security state. You know, I don't have to tell New Mexico that with Los Alamos laboratories right there. It's enormous compared to the national security state of other countries. And we obviously have to have some oversight over the things that take place within that realm. So whistleblowers help provide that oversight that's so needed.
You know, it's interesting. You said that these leaks, this whistleblowing on the part of Snowden did much more good than harm. It started this national debate, but not for Snowden. And you give one example after another of whistleblowers in the 20th century who exposed these terrible situations, wasteful, dangerous, unethical, And virtually every time they're demoted, they're fired, they're vilified. So it's basically, I mean, somebody like Snowden or some of these other people whom you profile, they basically know that they have a choice between their career and truth-telling.
Yes. Yes, and there's also sort of a tragic earnestness in a lot of the cases where the whistleblower really feels that if he or she lets the authorities know that this is going on, the authorities will share their concern and do something about it. And time and time again, what they find is that the leadership just wants to keep the status quo in place, and they're seen as a troublemaker, someone that's just not a team player. And so once they've taken that fateful step, a lot of things follow that they probably weren't expecting. So it's a dangerous game to be a whistleblower, especially in the national security realm. For my book, I interviewed all of the NSA whistleblowers, including Snowden, but I also interviewed the senior leadership of the NSA. That was a long and complicated process to be able to do that. And what I really found, not surprisingly, is that there were these two narratives with respect to Snowden that had very little in common, if anything. And so part of what I do in the book is try to tease out what the truth is in the midst of that. And I present my opinions, but I also try to give the reader enough information that they can judge for themselves whether I'm right or I'm wrong. But in the book, I ultimately argue that Snowden may one day be seen as our first traitor patriot.
Well, it's a very disturbing situation, and I think a lot of people know this and feel it, but to see it in black and white where the giant bureaucracies that you and I and everybody else who's listening are supporting with their tax dollars don't care about what's right and wrong. They care about preserving their power. I mean, that's the state we're in. You contrast Barack Obama's support of whistleblower protection when he was senator to then when he was president, aggressive prosecution of whistleblowers. And I mean, what is that?
What it is I think we're in a learning process about what whistleblowers do and how important they are and how they're important even in the national security realm. That same President Obama who persecuted a lot of whistleblowers is also the man who pardoned Chelsea Manning. So people can learn over time, and hopefully that's what we're in the process of doing. And for those who think there's this dark bureaucracy that's bent on retaining power at all costs, one need look no further than these very courageous, patriotic Americans from the State Department who are currently testifying before Congress and reflect a real commitment to public service, not to keeping themselves in power or to supporting some kind of conspiratorial deep state system that's bent on acting at odds with American interests. So I think you do see some real flashes of light and hope in that there are people who still believe that public service is possible, and the American people deserve that. But you're right. It's very unlikely that the powerful will relinquish their power without a fight. That's true in any situation, and it's true for whistleblower situations as well.
And when you add money, it's magnified hugely. And as everybody knows, since September 11th, an unimaginably huge amount of money has gone into the so-called war on terror in the national security state. And where there's that much money, there's inevitably greed, really terrible greed and corruption.
Yeah.
But there are things that keep whistleblowers from reporting it. And as you say, one of the things is that whistleblower protections are denied for those working in national security jobs. And another is this, because there's so much privatization, it's not clear who's protected if they're not actually a government employee. Or help us understand that.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, because, you know, national security has been privatized in so many ways, even in the intelligence community, contractors are doing the work that government employees used to do. And so I've told you how government employees are in a gray area when it comes to national security whistleblowing. It's even worse for contractors. And of course, Edward Snowden was a contractor. So many people said, you know, he should have complained from within. But as a contractor, I can guarantee you we would never have heard about the things he discovered if he had complained from within. And the additional bit of evidence I'd offer for you in that regard is that the man in charge of the NSA Inspector General office at the time of the Snowden leaks, he was removed from his position in 2016 for retaliating against a whistleblower.
Right.
So that's the problem with within the national security community is that one person's national security whistleblower can be another's insider threat, someone who's bent on leaking information that's going to help our enemies rather than help the United States of America. So it's a particularly fraught realm.
So here we are. I mean, we have the case of Edward Snowden, where his actions did lead to a national debate on surveillance and this whole question of spying on American citizens. And as you point out, virtually no terrorist threats were averted because of the Spying on American Citizens program.
Yeah.
But it's not clear at this point that citizens really believe that they have that much privacy, despite all of that, because we are in this sort of Facebook world where we don't, because it's this corporate government thing. We don't really have any power to protect ourselves except for opting out of the whole entire system. So here we are. There's huge disincentives to be a whistleblower. We're being asked to accept and pay for what you identify as two parallel governments, the one we know about that provides various services, but then the other parallel national security state that's unaccountable virtually every level, and our hands are pretty much tied. I mean, what do we say? Gee, I hope they're doing a good job with our money and let's just trust them? I mean, even with the people coming forward from the State Department and so on, there's still this whole gigantic, dark national security apparatus, which I'm not sure how many people really believe that they're doing a good job.
Yeah. Well, you know, whenever you've got something that's large and powerful and requires a lot of money and you don't know that much about it, it's easy to come up with all sorts of conspiracy theories. And I think that's what we're seeing. And it's understandable. But I would just point out two things in response to your question. The first thing I would point out is that, you know, in my interactions with the intelligence community, a lot of my preconceptions were dispelled because the people I met were patriotic Americans trying to protect the security of the United States. And so take, for example, the Trump campaign. When the Trump White House complains about spying on the Trump campaign, I just have to point out that the intelligence community should have been spying on the Trump campaign. Why? Because they had unprecedented interactions with Russian operatives. That's never happened before with any campaign. And when the intelligence community sees that, that's a red flag that needs to be investigated. And even, you know, myself, I could have a FISA warrant on me to have my communications surveyed. Why? Well, because I've interviewed Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden is charged under the Espionage Act. With that, he's a sworn enemy of the United States, and I'm having interaction with him. Well, they're supposed to watch me. So my whole point is that it's a really dangerous world we're in. So part of the secrecy is necessary, but obviously, you know, we don't want to destroy the thing we're trying to defend through excessive security measures. And that thing we're trying to defend is American democracy. So, you know, the solution is better whistleblower protection and greater oversight over these activities. That's the only solution. The other thing that you have to keep in mind is that the Fourth Amendment, which protects our right to privacy, it protects our right to privacy from government encroachment. It says nothing whatsoever about corporate encroachment on our right to privacy. So some have argued that we need a constitutional amendment to protect our right to privacy from corporate abuse. But that's a whole other realm that's just beyond the Constitution. That's obviously of tremendous importance in the ad-driven social media era.
Right, right. And this is the thing. I mean, you say, well, government, and especially the national security state, is full of patriotic Americans and it requires secrecy, but it also needs oversight. And it does need oversight because even within a group of quote-unquote patriotic Americans, there's still going to be people who are, you know, spying on their ex or, you know, doing all kinds of things that really are immoral and unethical and sometimes really harmful. I mean, that's just a kind of trivial example, but there are many more. So how is that oversight to be done in a state of secrecy?
Well, it's done by adherence to the Constitution and to legality, right? And we all know that, you know, lawyers can make all kinds of arguments about what's legal and illegal, and it becomes quite confusing. But adherence to the Constitution certainly beats an anything-goes approach where you can do whatever you want so long as it's going to keep the country safe. So that's the difference between a constitutional democracy and a dictatorship. In a dictatorship, the state apparatus can do whatever it wants, and they answer to the leader, not to the law.
But in other words, who enforces the law if what you're trying to oversee is the NSA or any of the other 17 intelligence agencies?
You have in place all kinds of interactions between the three branches of government in the national security realm. And the interesting thing about the Snowden leaks is things that were eventually declared illegal by the D.C. Court of Appeals were previously approved by all three branches of government. So the notion of what's legal and illegal can change over time. That's not necessarily going to make you feel better about the sorts of problems you've identified, but I can't stress enough how reference to the law in trying to figure out what's acceptable and unacceptable is infinitely better than reference to whatever the leader says it is, which is what takes place in authoritarian countries. And I think what you're seeing is that Donald Trump has that understanding of the rule of law.
Right. Absolutely.
He defines what's legal and illegal. And that's simply not how impartial justice should work.
No, but under a circumstance where you don't have that kind of authoritarian leader in place, but you've got somebody who respects the Constitution and the three branches of government and the system of checks and balances and so on, what is the vision for overseeing the legality of what employees of the NSA and its subcontractors are doing in a state of secrecy? In other words, who oversees it? How do they do that?
Well, you get a great example with the current Intelligence Committee whistleblower, because that whistleblower's complaint rose through the system, rickety though it might be. We can do more to shore it up, so it's not such a fraught path to blow the whistle in the intelligence community. But that complaint rose through the system and was turned over to Congress, and Trump appointees, both the Intelligence Committee Inspector General Michael Atkinson and the Acting Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, have said repeatedly that that complaint followed the rules, it followed the law, and they're Trump appointees. So in some sense, it's a miracle that that complaint came to light, and I want to see improvements. On the other hand, that's evidence of the system working, even if it's in a less than perfect way. So there's obviously things we can do to improve the situation and learn from what we've just experienced in the years ahead. And I'm hopeful that that's what Congress will do after the current crisis is passed.
I mean, this presidency has produced a lot of whistleblowers, and looking at the president's ties to Russia, you know, accusations of treason, corruption, misdeeds of all kinds. Do you see this changing and transforming the way that the country deals with whistleblowers, which, as we've discussed, has been pretty harsh?
You know, it goes in cycles in American history, and I think my book captures that. So hopefully when Trump has been removed from office, either through impeachment or through free and fair elections without Russian interference, the country will be able to examine what just happened and have Congress respond appropriately, because there's all kinds of things Congress can do. They can not only make national security whistleblowing not a contradiction in terms, as it previously almost is today, but they can pass laws that define what corruption is in the 21st century that interpret the Emoluments Clause for current circumstances. There's a variety of things that can be done in response to the abuse of power we've seen, and hopefully Congress will do that. The trouble is that great damage is being done both to our institutions, but also to our very idea of public service, and that's something that is enormously alarming, but it doesn't mean that it can't be reversed. This is a country that has fought a civil war and come together around American principles and ideals. There's no reason that can't happen again.
In the book, you don't really talk that much about corporate whistleblowing. You said that you'd gone through a lot of drafts. Are you going to write another book, or can we hear other things? Like, I guess, why did you not include corporate whistleblowing?
I didn't include corporate whistleblowing because I think it's different in kind from government whistleblowing because of this component of public service that we've been talking about so extensively. But yeah, I have a lot of material, and I'll definitely write some articles, and it's going to appear in my future writings for sure, because it's obviously of enormous importance as well. I really wanted the book, though, it expanded to be this voluminous size, and I really wanted it to move and be highly readable and just allow readers to understand the current situation we were in, where the intelligence community was blowing the whistle on Donald Trump for failing to uphold his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. You know, you could see that icy whistleblower coming when you viewed the Trump administration in historical context, and that's what I wanted the book to do. And so I made some choices so that it could be, you know, 200 pages long and not 600.
Right. So what my takeaway from what you're saying is that in order for a sprawling and sometimes very secretive bureaucracy to follow the law, you need whistleblowers. In other words, there aren't going to be agencies from within who are doing that policing in an effective manner. So whistleblowers are essential to the functioning of basically of the country.
They absolutely are. And what, you know, in an ideal world, what you'd want is for the whistleblowers to be able to bring these things to light within their organizations, be it, you know, a government agency or a corporation, and to have leadership say, wow, that's a big gap between our ideals and our rules and reality. We've got to close that gap and have it taken care of internally rather than playing out in the public eye through leaks to the media. But it's because leadership often doesn't want to hear these complaints that you see people turning to the press to draw attention to it. So, you know, better leadership in all our organizations can lead to fewer public domain whistleblowers, and that would be a good thing to strive for.
So in the conclusion of your book, you give three recommendations for what you'd like to see. What are those three things?
So at the end of the book, I suggest that we can do three things once the crisis has passed. We can end warrantless surveillance. You know, the evidence really shows that spying on Americans without a warrant doesn't really yield the gains that would merit doing so. We can also strengthen national security whistleblowing so that it's seen as an accepted and respected practice that's necessary for the functioning of democracy. And finally, I argue that as a kind of symbolic refounding, if you will, the next president, whoever he or she might be, could pardon Edward Snowden as a means of acknowledging the importance of whistleblowing, especially in the national security realm, and moving forward in a way that better oversight is a feature of our shared life together as Americans. Those are three things I'd like to see, and they're not entirely impossible if there's a change in leadership.
Allison Stanger is author of the book Whistleblowers, Honesty in America from Washington to Trump. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors of the Radio Cafe, the Lanel Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, Lenzic Performing Arts Center, Southwest Care, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanel Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.